If you found $100 on the street, would you pick it up or keep walking? Of course you'd take the money. So why do you keep picking winners and not betting on them? That's why I go to MyBookie. It's fast, it's easy, and they pay you when you win. Let's face it, where you're betting is just as important as who you're betting on. Do the smart thing. If you're going to bet this football season, bet with MyBookie. Did you know you could bet on games after kickoff? If by the second half it looks like your bet is going to lose, you can always just take the other side. If you're the kind of guy that likes to bet a little and win a lot, try a parlay. If all your picks come through, you'll multiply your winnings. And no matter how you bet, the NFL season is the best time of year. Join now and MyBookie will double your first deposit. Use promo code BLUEWIRE to activate the offer. That's promo code BLUEWIRE. Visit mybookie.ag today. You play, you win, you get paid. Hello Bulls fans and welcome to another episode of Bulls HQ, a Chicago Bulls podcast on the Blue Wire Sports Podcasting Network. Thank you for joining me again this week, where now I can officially gloat about Australia being better than America. We probably typically already knew that anyway, but in terms of the World Cup, if we look specifically at the results, you can make that assumption too. And unfortunately, whilst Australia weren't able to win gold themselves, at the very least, they did place higher than Team USA, which is a massive victory for myself. So I'm going to take this opportunity to get on the podcast, to get on my soapbox and to gloat about it, even though I personally had nothing to do with the result. But here to gloat about America's shortcomings at the World Cup is another Bulls fan from abroad. You all surely know him by now. He's Morten Jensen from the NBA podcast. And Mort, I'm sure you're as happy as me to see the US fall to France in the quarterfinals of the World Cup.
I mean, I think you're way more invested than I am, but I am definitely enjoying basically the big mental breakdown on Twitter that day. That was that. Wow. It was so weird because so many people were all up in arms about this. But when it was announced, you know, the final roster, people were like, okay, it doesn't matter. I don't care anyway. It doesn't matter. It's not the Olympics. I'm not even going to watch. And then when they got bounced, it was like, this is a travesty, a scandal. This is the worst thing that's happened to American basketball. Like, what? Like, pick a lane.
Yeah, it's funny because, like, I don't know how many Americans, I guess, follow the World Cup. I don't think it's something that grips them in the way it does the international fan, which I get, I understand. Obviously, I'm rooting for Australia. I was hoping to see them win gold. That's not going to happen, unfortunately, but nonetheless, pretty happy with how their World Cup has gone about. But like I said, because in large part, because they finished above the US, because if your team can't win the World Cup, what you want to see is see the US lose, which is, a victory in itself. So I'm very pleased to see Team USA lose the World Cup. That was great for me. But I bring up the World Cup, one, so I can get my jabs into all my American listeners, and hopefully they haven't tuned out by now. I'm hoping that's not the case. Let me get in a few punches whilst I can, because I'm sure things will change at the Olympics in a year or so. But the reason why I wanted to bring up the World Cup more so than just to have a few jabs at American listeners who'll be tuning in is because I wanted to loop that into Bulls point guard Tomas Satoransky, who he and his Czech Republic side also happened to finish above Team USA at the World Cup. They were brilliant in the World Cup themselves. They finished sixth. Unfortunately, they lost to Serbia in that fifth place qualifier. So Tomas Satoransky and the Czech Republic finished sixth, the US team in seventh. So I casually wanted to throw that out there so we could segue our way into Satoransky, who was brilliant in this World Cup.
He was tremendous. So here's the thing, right? We have seen him play 3 years in Washington, where he's played off of great stars who are ball dominant, who's going to take a lot of shots. And this is the first time we've seen him at this stage in a featured role to the same extent during a high performance tournament. And what he did was very, very impressive. I obviously, when you have an NBA player who plays with a supporting cast that is significantly less than what he is in terms of quality and talent, you are going to see that player increase his volume, increase his the level of responsibility. But what, how he did it and how he performed and how he continued to kind of match his own or match the countries that he played against energy and execution was outstanding to me. I was very, very surprised at how he handled himself in a featured role, because you could see the way the teams defended him. They were locking on to him and zeroing in on him and trying to basically stop him from initiating the offense every single time, and he broke through. I'm not sure I have the updated stats here. I don't remember if the Czech Republic played 7 or 8 games, but so excuse me if these are one game away from being the accurate ones. But the line I'm looking at right now is 16 points, 6 rebounds, and 9 assists.
There is final numbers.
Those are his final numbers. Okay.
Yeah.
That's an incredible line, and then you combine it with you know, 89% free throw shooting, 45% from downtown on fairly high volume. He was efficient. He was all over the place, dishing, rebounding, and I really had my eyes opened in towards just how talented he was. I always liked him in Washington, but this really gave me some very positive mojo for him moving forward. I think he should be the starting point guard, absolutely, just the way he runs the offense. Like, defensively, he's not going to be Chris Dunn, I'll say as much. But at 6'7", and agile, and with some sneaky athleticism, I don't think he's going to be bad either, necessarily. I'm very, very stoked about him just getting into a new situation where that's not Washington, where he seemed to be handcuffed for 3 years.
Look, I didn't watch every single game that he played, but I obviously watched all of his minutes against Australia. I thought he was pretty instrumental in that game. He didn't have his best shooting game in that specific game itself. He was 5 from 12 from the field, but you could tell just from watching the way he was playing and the way Australia was guarding, to your point, he was that sole focus for that Australian defense. And that would have been the case for every other defense that were sort of matching up against the Czech Republic. They had some good players on their squad too, not necessarily some NBA caliber players, but Satoransky was clearly the first option that teams were looking to shut down. And I think that's what was interesting to see, the fact that he was playing in that role, but just how he was able to impact a game, even on nights that he didn't necessarily shoot the ball well. Like I mentioned in that Australia game, only shot 42%, but he can fill up a stat sheet and he can still affect a game in a lot of ways, to the point where against the Australians, he was grabbing and going off the glass and really getting that Czech Republic side into transition, where I guess they were probably better or more... It was probably better for them to be in that transition where they didn't have to necessarily set up in half court and have to go up against a set defense with having, I guess, a roster that didn't necessarily have that caliber of scorers that they needed to have to play that half court offense, where you can score 80, 90 points in the half court like a supreme Spain team or something like that. So getting out on the break and leading that break off a defensive rebound is something that really caught my eye from Satoransky in this tournament, and it's obviously something we can expect in his time in Chicago. I mean, he was one rebound shy of a triple-double against my Australian side, so... And he did that a lot on the defensive end, where he was grabbing the rebound and really pushing in transition. And that's one of the reasons why he had 13 assists in that game as well. So 13 points, 13 assists, 9 rebounds against the Australian side. But there were so many games where he was putting up 7 rebounds, 7 assists, or, you know, 9 assists, 6 rebounds, whatever the stat line was. Yeah. He was doing things, even when he wasn't necessarily scoring, that would, I guess, fill up the entire box score and would sort of really indicate that he can do a lot of damn things well. And I think the thing that was very, very clear to me was just how smart he was. And I think that's going to be the biggest difference that we Bulls fans are going to have to get used to, the fact that we're actually got a point guard in here that can run pick and roll, which is not a thing that we've had for years.
Absolutely. And especially a guy who can play pick and roll by not necessarily... projecting what he's going to do. You know that when Chris Dunn is going into a pick and roll, like most of the time he's going to try to attack off the bounce off of that screen and roll. Satoransky, with his shooting ability and his very sublime passing skills, and the fact that he's 6'7" and can't get to the rim offers three different levels of executions off a pick and roll. And then when you add like in Lauri Markkanen, who can both roll and pop, that just means that there are so many opportunities that opens up in that scenario. So Satoransky should, on paper and in theory at least, open up the entire offense. What I'm mostly looking forward to from him is there's this idea that he's going to be the perfect Zach LaVine backcourt mate. I'm actually on board in part with that logic, because he's not a guy who necessarily wants X amount of shots every single night. But at the same time, when he gets an opportunity, he's not going to pass it up. He's going to take advantage. And I feel as though Bulls fans are looking at Satoransky saying, oh, this is a guy who's going to be completely fine just spotting up and doing nothing else. Well, maybe in some case that is absolutely true, but he's also not a guy who's going to turn down driving lanes. He's not a guy who's going to just be passive all the time. This is going to be a guy who is hard-nosed, who is going to get his just by being efficient and picking his spots. He's a very careful shooter. But that shouldn't be mistaken for him being passive necessarily, which I think is a very important distinction.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, he's a player that's not scared if we listen to Jim Boylan, and I'm not sure if you got a chance to read that that interesting piece that...
I'm pretty sure I was the one who linked it to you.
Yeah, actually, you were. That Joe Cowley piece is the one that I'm referencing, where he obviously went straight to the source being Jim Boylan, who had some interesting all-around quotes, as he typically does, old Jimbo there. But he made the point that Satoransky isn't a player that is... Well, he's not a player that gets scared, I guess, and to your exact point, that's not the case. I mean, he will be someone who will happily spot up for that open three. He shot 48% in the World Cup, but he's more creative than that. He can get to the hole. And I mean, he had a huge dunk against Australia right on the three-quarter time buzzer, where he basically drove the entire lane and just threw down a one-handed hammer, and that was a huge way to end that third quarter for his Czech side, and he sort of brought his team back into the game at that point. So he is more creative than some Bulls fans may think him.
You must have been so conflicted with that play.
It was interesting. Well, like I said before the game, if Satoransky can put up a triple-double and in a loss and Australia wins, then I'll be pleased. And he's, like I said, he's one rebound away from that triple-double. Australia got that win. So I was happy all around. It was conflating at sometimes, or conflicting rather at sometimes, particularly on that dunk. But I'm looking forward to Satoransky. I probably haven't been this excited about a Bulls point guard in some time, because we have been deprived of good point guard play, and I think with Satoransky in the fold, it should be a lot better, which I'm pleased to see, I guess. We haven't seen it just yet, but I'm projecting forward. But I feel comfortable in saying that Satoransky is going to be a success, just because he is that level player, level-headed player. He's not one that makes necessarily a ton of mistakes. He's just a smart player, and you need smart players on the roster. And I guess that leads me to my next few questions, and I want to talk about this point guard rotation. But I got a question in here from Felipe Carvalhais, and he asks, and I always butcher Felipe's last name, but he asks, obviously with Chris Dunn being on the roster still, and it doesn't appear that Chris Dunn's going anywhere in the short term, but do you think, because there's Satoransky along on the roster, there's obviously Kobe White, there's a few other point guards on the roster too, that do you think there's a chance that Chris Dunn could function as a small ball wing of sorts, to maybe be supported by a player like Satoransky out there on the court, where the Bulls run those multiple point guard lineups or multiple ball handler lineups? Do you think Dunn can be a small ball wing of sorts? Do you think that's in the cards?
That's an interesting question, because I actually talked about that on my show, the NBA podcast. And there are some similarities in terms of Dunn and a Tony Allen, in terms of the defense at least, not offense. Long, athletic, very, very disruptive. And Dunn is 6'4". Stephen Noah of The Athletic has banged on this drum that Dunn could play the two. I don't think that he's wrong. He's got the size. He's got the defensive know-how. The Bulls are somewhat thin on the wing as is. So if you play him up a position or two even, I don't think it ruins everything. What's his wingspan again? Chris Dunn's like 6'9", 6'10"?
Yeah, I don't know off the top of my head, but it's definitely, like, you can just tell by looking at him that he's got long-ass limbs.
Very, very long arms, right? And 6'4", that's a pretty, like, in today's game where everything is trending, you know, a little downwards in terms of size, I wouldn't even mind having him play some small forward minutes, as long as the it has just to be about his disposition to the game. Like, it doesn't have to be him going off like pick and roll basketball. He has to come in with the mindset of, oh, okay, I have to defend my ass off. My role is defending first and foremost, taking open shots when it's there. You know, and that doesn't mean jump shots necessarily. It can mean drives or just, you know, open dunks or whatever. Just don't pound the ball into the pavement for 16 seconds. That's not your role anymore, because now Satoransky is there, Kobe White is there. Both are, well, not maybe Kobe White isn't necessarily to be projected to be better in his rookie season offensively, but both of those guys on paper offer better offensive execution on that end. So that just kind of lessens Dunn's importance on that end of the floor. So his priorities have to change. I think the Bulls fans that are against Dunn saying that he's not an NBA player are wrong. That's not fair. I think he's absolutely an NBA player. I just think it's about time he figures out what type of NBA player he is. And if I were him, I would lean towards just defense and becoming more of a wing than a natural point guard. Absolutely. And Felipe, by the way, thanks for doing the thing with the thing. You know what I'm talking about. Thank you.
I have no idea what you're talking about, but I'm sure Felipe does.
Felipe knows.
But I think the Dunn, hate's too strong a word, but the Dunn backlash has gone too far. I'm certainly no Chris Dunn fan. I've said it on here multiple times. I would be happy to see him traded for a wing or whatever it may be. But I think the reaction to Chris Dunn falling out as, I guess, the point guard of the future, now that there are a few new point guards on board, be it Kobe White, be it Satoransky, whoever the shiny new toy is, I think the reaction to Dunn or the negativity to Dunn has swayed too far at this point, to the point where people can't think he can play with another, you know, another guard out there, that he can only be a point guard. And I don't know if that's true. I understand that he and Levine had struggles last season playing together, but that was often in lineups that didn't make necessarily any offensive sense at all. And if you think, you know, you had Zach LaVine out there often with Chris Dunn, but there wasn't much shooting to support those guys with, or much creativity to support those guys with. Often they were playing in lineups with Jabari Parker and Robin Lopez, or, you know, Chandler Hutchinson, or whoever it may have been, these inadequate offensive lineups where, of course, Chris Dunn is going to look bad out there because he's got no room to move, and he's going to be looking even worse when he's sort of doing nothing off the ball when Zach LaVine has it. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's not necessarily just a Chris Dunn problem. It's also a problem of the rest of the five-man unit out there. So I think the negative reaction at this point against Dunn has probably gone too far. I don't know what's in store for Dunn for this season with the Bulls. I think it's still likely that he's going to be shipped off at some point, but I think they have to try him as a wing at some point, because they do have too many wings on this roster. And we talk about the multiple ball handler lineup, and this team doesn't necessarily have a lot of ball handlers on it, and Chris Dunn is actually one of the few that they do have on this roster. So I think there will be occasions when he's out there with Zach LaVine, out there with Tomas Satoransky, and it's possible that he may be the first player off the bench, and maybe he subs in for Otto Porter, whatever it may be. And
yeah,
I guess one of those players becomes a de facto point guard, but they're probably going to be switching it up to the point where Dunn at some point will be a wing. And I mean, it's up to him to improve as a shooter, but I think, to Felipe's point, I think they should try it at some point. But another question that we got in around this point guard rotation is around Ryan Arcidiacono, obviously my guy here, but how much playing time should we expect for Arcidiacono now that Satoransky is here? We've obviously talked about Dunn maybe playing some wing minutes, but do you think Arch will get some minutes here? And do you think he will actually get some more minutes than someone like Kobe White, who is coming in as an inexperienced point guard and someone still learning to be that point guard?
I think the possibility of that exists, absolutely. The Bulls are going to try to make the playoffs, not just this year, but next year, because they want to be as attractive as possible going into the 2021 free agency. And if you can go to a free agent in 2021 and say, hey, you know what? We just made two playoff appearances. We have a lot of, you know, young players who have grown in the playoff series that we've played in, then that's a huge draw. And a part of that is playing players who are more experienced. Right now, you know, as we're saying this, Ryan Arcidiacono is a way more experienced NBA player than Kobe White, for obvious reasons. Now, that's not an indictment on Kobe White's ability or his shooting potential or anything else. Like, he projects to be the better NBA player down the line. But this year, you know, I could definitely see a scenario wherein Ryan Arcidiacono is somewhat comfortably better.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one. And I got that question in from Average Joe OPK. So I don't know where he necessarily stands on the situation, but I think Arch will be getting minutes in the rotation for sure. I think it'll be interesting to see how Boylan handles this thing, because inevitably there are going to be point guards playing shooting guard. There are going to be point guards playing small forward, whether that's Chris Dunn, whether that's Satoransky, whether it's Kobe White, whoever it may be. I think it's going to be a combination, but that does leave minutes for Ryan Arcidiacono to get minutes at point guard, because some of those other point guard options will be on the wing. And that may be as soon as the season starts. We don't know, I guess, the extent of Chandler Hutchinson's injury. I spoke about that last week on the podcast. Obviously, he was ruled out indefinitely, so I don't know what that means for Hutchinson. But if that means someone like Dunn or Satoransky has to get some minutes at the 2 or 3, then that opens up more minutes at point guard, meaning Arch will be getting more minutes at the point guard spot. But to your point, he's that more seasoned guy. He's more experienced, and the Bulls are gunning for the playoffs. I don't think that should be something they should shy away from. And I think at this point, heading into year three of the rebuild, it should be about progressing towards to the playoffs. Whether you make it or not, I think that should be the goal. So it'll be interesting to see how the Bulls manage that point guard rotation, but I feel a lot more comfortable about it now that Satoransky is in the fold, and I think they do have some variability to it as well. So it's going to be an interesting situation. But I want to come back, Mort, and I want to talk about Sports Illustrated's top 100, because that's probably been the other thing that us Bulls fans have been raging on about this week. I want to talk about that after the break, but let's tell the listeners about this week's sponsors. There are countless ways to keep up with what's happening in the world of sports, but how are you supposed to read every great article? How are you supposed to watch every awesome highlight without losing time in your busy day? Scrolling through every app and visiting every website on a daily basis is impossible. Now coming to the stage, Axios Sports. Axios Sports is a modern sports page delivered directly to your email inbox. Each morning, you'll see the best stories from around the sports world, from the NBA and the NFL to niche sports like cricket and ping pong. The email newsletter highlights the most important stats and trends, giving you the ability to stay informed. It's super simple to sign up. Go to sports.axios.com. Axios Sports is clean, crisp, and gives you everything you need to know. Read it in 5 minutes in the elevator or discover a deep dive article while you're on the train to work. Not only will you be caught up, you'll be the cool person sharing an amazing link with your friends and co-workers. Join the 100,000 sports fans who get caught up on the day before it even begins. And best of all, there's no paywall, no subscription fee, nothing. This is free curated sports content delivered directly to you. Do yourself and your time a favor. Sign up for the Axios Sports newsletter for free at sports.axios.com. Seriously, I subscribe to it and it makes me feel more informed without spending time clicking through websites, apps, and social media platforms. Again, try it for free at sports.axios.com. Guys are terrible at taking care of their health. Whether it's a knee injury, bad back, or something worse, guys are usually more comfortable rubbing some dirt in it than seeing a doctor. I'm guilty of this myself. My back has been playing up for months and I have not been to a doctor to get this checked out at all. And the same is true for erectile dysfunction. Studies show 70% of guys who experience ED don't get treated for it. Thankfully, Roman created an easy way to chat with a doctor online. With Roman, you can get medical care for ED, if appropriate, from the comfort and privacy of your own home. You can handle everything online in a convenient, discreet manner. Getting started is simple. Just go to roman.com/bluewire and complete an online visit. If your doctor decides that treatment would be appropriate, they can prescribe genuine medication that can be delivered in discreet packaging right to your door with free two-way shipping. Guys, go talk to the doctor. Erectile dysfunction can be tough to tackle, but it's really important to get it checked out. With Roman, it's easy to connect with a doctor. Just go to roman.com/bluewire to get a free online visit and free two-day shipping. That's roman.com/bluewire for a free visit to get started. Get roman.com/bluewire. All right, back to the show now. And more, like I said, I wanted to talk about the SI Top 100. There's the few Bulls mentioned that Top 100, which I guess is positive in itself, but I don't know. I've got some takes on this, but the rhetoric around it was, I guess, somewhat negative by the Bulls fan base, at least from, I guess, some of the things that I've seen online, at least. So I guess for those who may not have read the SI Top 100, there was four Bulls in the Top 100. So Otto Porter was actually the highest ranked Bull at number 57. Thad Youngkamp came in at number 70. Lauri Markkanen not far behind him at 75. And then Zach LaVine at 90. So there was a lot of conversation about this, as there typically is, not just amongst Bulls fan base, but, you know, just NBA fans at large, you know, mostly by people who felt their guy was snubbed or their guy was way too down the list. And obviously that's something the Bulls fans were definitely talking about, in particular with Zach LaVine. But I want to get your initial thoughts off the top, at least. What did you think about where these Bulls were sort of situated in the top 100?
I mean, Zach LaVine at 90th was... That was pretty atrocious, to be honest with you. I'm not a guy who was very high on Zach coming into the Bulls necessarily. I think he did very well last year, all things considered. He's not a great defensive player, we all know that, but he did score the ball at a high rate, and his efficiency level was above league average, which is not something anyone really anticipated. Offensively, he's extremely dynamic, and that does carry value. It seems to me that this list really took defenders and put them on a pedestal, which is fine. I mean, lists are objective, subjective, of course. So that's a part of it. But in no way do I see Al-Farouq Aminu, who's at 84th, being a better player than Zach LaVine, and especially in terms of team importance, team role, on-court production, minutes, whatnot. I mean, it's basically... just a way of saying, hey, we are going to penalize players who score the ball and don't play much on the other end, which is fine. But then you have a lot of defenders who really aren't necessarily great offensive players either. And I think basketball in today's day and age, it needs to be a two-way game. And also, I also subscribe to the theory that elite offense will always beat elite defense. So from where I'm coming from, I always lean slightly towards offense over defense. That's besides the point. The Zach LaVine ranking, I feel, was too low by probably 15 to 20 slots. And because I don't think you can put Julius Randle, for example, at 79. And say, oh, he's significantly better. Yeah, I mean, he scores a lot and he rebounds and he pushes the ball, but he's just as atrocious a defender as LaVine. If anything, they should be neck and neck. So yeah, I have a problem with that one. I feel that wasn't really too great. Lauri Markkanen at 75, I kind of get it because, you know, talking to people around, you know, the NBA Twitter sphere, who aren't Bulls fans and who are just looking at it from the outside, there's a lot of opinions about Lauri Markkanen being a guy who you don't know who is yet or what he is yet, considering the injuries. You know, he came into last year with the elbow. He missed games in his first year as well. So there is this thing hanging over him. Can he put a full season together? Which I think is fair. That's a fair criticism. Whether that played into his ranking or not, I can't say, but I have to assume that it did, because a healthy Lauri Markkanen, I would assume to be higher than 75. I have no problem with Otto Porter being the highest one. I do feel, you know, look, Markkanen should be a little bit ahead of Thaddeus Young, but otherwise no qualms with the Bulls.
Yeah, see, my thoughts about this whole thing is, I agree with everything that you just noted there, particularly about Zach LaVine. I probably think that he should be at least 80th, not 90th. Yeah. I mean, it's give or take. It's ultimately a subjective list. And I guess that's my overall opinion on this whole thing, is I don't know why people get so heated about this whole topic of making lists or of making evaluations based on, you know, a top 100 or whatever it may be, because the entire thing is always subjective and there is never a universal criteria that people follow. And I guess another thing to note is SI pretty clearly sort of outlined as to how they would be judging players, what criteria they do use. And if we know anything about Rob Mahoney, who put this together for SI, he often refers to advanced analytics, and they figure quite a bit into the criteria for a player like Zach LaVine. And he uses advanced analytics and how those players sort of grade out on those to help make his top 100. And a player like LaVine has traditionally been a poor performer in advanced analytics. So when you sort of factor in the criteria that SI use themselves to create their list, then I'm not 100% shocked as to where Zach falls. That doesn't necessarily mean I agree with it, but I guess I just don't understand the outrage when you factor into the criteria that was applied by SI. We can disagree with the criteria, but I just don't understand the outrage, I suppose, is my point. I don't agree with it, but I don't also want to spend... I don't understand why people expend so much energy on complaining about these things, I guess.
Well, it's traditional off-season fodder, isn't it? I mean, we see it every single year. The regular season and the playoffs, it's been over a couple months. Everyone seems to be hungry for basketball again. There's nothing really on, you know, the World Cup kind of takes you a little bit. It's like a fix, but it's not really... You see people on Twitter just going nuts about talking about preseason. Like, when's preseason going to come here? And then when preseason's there, that's not going to fill the gap because then you want the regular season. So this is just one of those things that has to happen every single year. It also feels like we always have way more GOAT debates during the off season. It certainly feels that way. Like, Kobe Bryant's name is always brought up more during the offseason as well. Like, where does he rank as a shooting guard? That's where we kind of take ourselves away from the current game and go into like the history books, and we start with like the big overviews. Okay, so who's number one? And what about the league today? Who's number one in the league today? Who's the top 10 point guards? And, you know, big editorials make slideshows, and it's just traditional summer fodder. And it is what it is. And look, the SI article, it did what it was supposed to do. It drew clicks, man. It got a lot of clicks.
I mean, we're talking about it on this podcast despite my insistence, the fact that we shouldn't be wasting that much energy arguing about it. And I guess we're not necessarily arguing about it, but we are talking about it. So I guess they've achieved their goal. But yeah, I mean, I just don't get it, I suppose, because people view things through their own criteria. They'll see Lowry at 75 and they'll see someone at Harrison Barnes who's above Lowry, and they'll think, why would any team want Lowry above Harrison Barnes? And maybe there would be more teams that would want Lowry than Harrison Barnes on their specific team, depending on their context. But based on SI's context and their criteria, I just don't understand why people get too upset about it. And I guess the other thing that maybe Bulls fans were maybe surprised to see was to see Otto and Thad above Zach and Lowry. And again, I'm not surprised by that either, based on SI's criteria, but also my own personal criteria, because Otto and Thad, even though I don't think they have the ceilings that a player like Lowry or even Zach project to have, I think right now, based on the upcoming season, if we're just thinking about the upcoming season, which again is another criteria for this top 100, it's not a list based on who would you rather have in 3 years' time, it's based on the upcoming season. It's not surprising to think that a player like Otto or Thad will be the most productive player on this Bulls roster next season, and I think that's more than fair to think about. And I don't know, so I guess I just don't know why people get too upset about it. But I got a question in here from P. Varaparate, and he asked me a question. Based on the projected rotation, will Boylan use Thad as the first big off the bench and use him to stagger Lowry and Wendell Carter Jr. so they both get minutes at center? So I guess when you're factoring that question based as well on the top 100, and you have like a player like Thad coming off the bench, and he's ranked higher than Lowry, he's ranked higher than Zach, and obviously he's ranked higher than Wendell, who didn't even figure in the top 100. Mm. I guess it's hard for people to compute the whole top 100 thing and how a player like Thad could be rated higher than Lowry, given that Thad may be coming off the bench. But let's pivot away from the top 100 and pivot into some listener questions. And let's answer that one first from PV. He asked that question about Thad Young. And do you think Boylan is going to be using Thad as that first big off the bench in order to stagger Lowry and Wendell's minutes into that center spot?
I mean, look at the contract he got. I would be very surprised if that didn't come with a very specific job description of being the first guy off the bench, even not just the first big. I wouldn't be surprised if he's like generally the first player off. I do want to see Lowry and Wendell play a lot of minutes together, because they are the future of the team in many respects. I think it's absolutely crucial that they get time together and grow and develop chemistry on the court. But the Bulls also have to, as we talked about previously, they also have to look at the playoffs as a as a target. And Thad Young, who is, he's 31, right? So right in the middle of his prime, he is a tremendous two-way player. Playing him is going to lead, with a higher certainty at least, to more wins. So he's going to get a lot of minutes. And presumably almost at the four, because then you move Laurie up to the five, you sit Wendell and all that. So yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if that's the route. But I would also be disappointed if Laurie and Wendell did not get 20 minutes together a night.
Yeah, I 100% agree. And I hope the plan is for Thad to come off the bench and not be that starter next to Larry at the five or something crazy like that. I'm hoping that's not the case, but I think Thad is going to be that bench piece who can slide in at four and fit perfectly either alongside Wendell or Lowry. So I think that is definitely going to be the case, PV. So at least I'm hoping that's how Boylan uses him. But we also got in a question here, Mort, from Christian at vitaminc_21 on Twitter. He asks, how do you feel about the buzz of Lowry running at the five this season? Obviously, we just spoke about Lowry potentially playing some center minutes, and obviously we would like to see him and Wendell playing as many minutes together as possible. But obviously, Lowry will be running some of his minutes at the five. The Bulls have made that pretty clear that he will be playing some time at center. But how do you generally feel about the buzz around Lowry playing at center? I don't think you and I have had much to talk about in that sense. I don't think we've had that discussion amongst ourselves.
Well, I don't love the idea of Laurie at the five. I don't think he is the traditional five man, honestly. Remember when he came out of college, I think it was Ricky O'Donnell who actually said that he was almost like a 7-foot shooting guard, statistically speaking. And that was interesting. Like, obviously, he's turned that around. He's become a very, very good rebounder. And he is, you know, I don't even know what to call that Laurie a patented drive he has, where he kind of slows down, like kind of the drag runner. I'm not really sure what it is, but that's a big man move in some respects as well. So he's evolved into becoming more of a big, but I think, you know, playing the center spot is taking it one bit too far. He seems like a very pure four man in my eyes. And Cole Swicker, who you had on the podcast, I heard that. That was a great episode, by the way. And Cole's article on Wendell, I mean, woof, I'm almost blushing here right now just thinking about it. That's so great a piece. But he was also like, Laurie's kind of like a pure four or a straight up four. And I agree with that. I think he's just that this generation's type of four. I don't necessarily think he's one of those has to fill in at center spot who's going to be a great defensive player and all that. No, you just run him loose as the four man and then let Wendell and Luke Kornet and potentially down the road Daniel Gafford play the center minutes. That's fine. Laurie at the four seems like a very good fit. And then when he sits, you can play small without a Porter coming in. This is after Thaddeus Young, you know, in a couple of years. And then Otto Porter can come in and play the four, and it can go a little bit small. Like, yeah, you can give spot minutes to Laurie at the five. I don't have any problem with that. But in terms of playing him like a significant percentage of his minutes at the five, I just don't see the benefit.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I mean, I just don't see him as that center that this team needs. And the reason I say that is obviously the court is connected. Both ends of the court are connected. And if we're thinking about the entire court itself, I just don't think Lowry at the five makes full functional sense. Because whilst I think there is obviously offensive advantages to having Lowry at the five, the defensive side of the ball is where things get concerning for me. And just the thought of him having to body up against some of the biggest centers in the NBA, I think that's going to go poorly for Lowry. So I don't like the idea of it happening too much. I think in certain spots or in certain rotations or in certain matchups, it definitely is something that the Bulls should be exploiting. But yeah, I think this potential move I hope they're not testing Lowry at the five this season as a potential move to making that full-time going forward, because I completely agree. I think he's a power forward. I don't think he has enough center chops to be that full-time center. He definitely doesn't have that rim protection. He doesn't have that defensive ability to be that center spot, or to be that full-time center rather. So to think of Lowry as someone that can transition to five over time, I think that is a mistake. Can he pinch it at the five at points during the season? Yes, I think that is something that the Bulls will do and should do and he can do, but I hope they don't think it's anything more grand than that, because I don't think he is that center option going forward. But I got another question in about Lowry, and I'm not surprised to see that Bulls fans are obviously got their attention and their focus on Lowry Markkanen, because he is probably, for most fans at least, maybe the most appeal, the most or the highest projection. So I'm not surprised to see a lot of questions come in from Lowry, but this one came in from Jermaine Jones, and he wanted to talk about Lowry posting up, because it seems that a lot of people these days are against modern day bigs hitting the post in the modern NBA. And I guess he just wanted to ask or wanted to seek out our feedback as to whether it would be effective to play Lowry in the same way that maybe the Mavs did with Dirk Nowitzki. And Dirk wasn't necessarily just a face-up big. He did play in the post a little, I guess, as well. So he's not necessarily suggesting the Bulls should play Lowry all in the post, but do you think there should be some more variability to Lowry's game, where he's not necessarily just a face-up pick-and-pop guy, but whether he should develop as a post option as well?
Yeah, I do. But here's the thing. Post option can mean a lot of things. Being a post option doesn't mean that you get the ball and then you spend 10 seconds backing down and making Hakeem Olajuwon dream shakes and then finishing with a shot. No, it can be just asserting yourself on the block, making a quick move and getting a bucket, which would just make your defender know, oh, okay, he's got that in his back. So next time down the court, the defender goes a little bit harder, maybe gives him a little bit less of space, which opens up the driving lanes. And in that case, hey, Zach LaVine driving down the lane with 116 miles an hour, I'm going to hit you with a quick bounce pass. Boom, there's a dunk. So it's about what you can achieve from the post-ups. It's about, can you pass out of them? Can you see the court? Can you initiate plays? If you can score from it, fine, at least if it's a high percentage shot. That doesn't necessarily mean it has to be with the back to the basket. It can be, you know, backing down a little bit and then fading away. That's fine. I don't mind a fadeaway shot from the post, even though it's not great percentage. I don't mind it if it means that the layers added from having that ability in the bag opens up the court for everyone else. If that's the ultimate conclusion of it, hell yeah, diversify.
I mean, you stole my thunder there, because that's exactly going to be my question. And I think we're too quick at this point in the modern NBA to say a player like Wendell or a player like Lowry should just be purely 100% face-up bigs, whilst I definitely think and agree that that's obviously their primary skill, and that's what the Bulls should be exploiting, the use of their jump shot and their use to space the floor.
Yep.
You do need some variability, because at some point the game does become a half-court offense, and you do need some post play, even if it's not necessarily just having Lowry being back to the basket center and pounding away, trying to run off a hook shot or something like that. Even just having him in there as a passing hub, I think, is critical. And this, you can apply the same thought to Wendell Carter. Maybe it's more applicable to Wendell, but having him in the post as a passing hub makes complete sense for this Bulls roster that doesn't have a lot of playmaking. They don't have a lot of perimeter guys out there that can do things off the bounce. And if you're rebuilding around two young bigs, then you can't necessarily have your two bigs on the perimeter and asking them to do things off dribble drives, off the perimeter to create for you. But they can potentially do that for you either at the elbow or on the low block. And whether that's with their back to the basket or not, I mean, that remains to be seen. But you can mix it up, and it's probably healthy for the Bulls and their players to be doing that, not only for their own development, but like you said, to give the defense a different look. So
yeah,
let's assume if Lowry was to take 15 shots a game, we're not necessarily advocating for Lowry to take, you know, 5 or 6, maybe even 7 of his field goal attempts as back to the basket post-ups as if he was Robin Lopez. We're not suggesting that, but if 2, maybe 3 of his possessions come on the block where he's either making a move for himself or making an aggressive move from the right block all the way to the left-hand side of the paint to hit a guy in the corner, then that's something that should be part of the Bulls' offense too. So similar thing to what I said before about Chris Dunn, where we've gone too far on our perception of Chris Dunn, and I think we've also gone too far with our perception of post play in the NBA as well. I think it's definitely something that should remain, not necessarily as a back to the basket Patrick Ewing style type of offense, but I think the Bulls need that variability, and someone like Lowry I think could be an interesting playmaker off the block, and that's certainly the case for Wendell too. So yeah, it's an interesting thing to talk about, but I think we've gone too far with our negative reactions around post play in the NBA.
Yeah, and there's a guy I want Lowry to really look at, by the way. Pascal Siakam from Toronto, and also Bulls fan in general. Like, if you have a chance, check him out. He's a guy who understands to use the post. He can score from there, but when he goes down there, every option is open to him. Like, he's surveying the floor every single second that he's backing his defender down. He's looking at cutters, and if he doesn't find anything, that's when he's gonna make a play for himself. But otherwise, it's pass first, score second, and he's doing that even though he has a wide variety of moves in the post. Like, Pascal Siakam, honestly, could probably average 10 post points a game, and somewhat efficiently if he wanted to. But he's just a very team-oriented guy, so he's looking for the pass first and foremost. But just having that thing in the back for him has opened up Toronto's offense so much. That was a big part of why they won the championship. It allowed Kawhi to make all those small, slippery cuts. Kawhi himself, by the way, great post player who understands to use it correctly. So you had, you know, Kawhi on the one side, you had Pascal Siakam on the other. Then you threw in Marc Gasol, who is like a third guy who can also play in the post. Like, Toronto really had a bunch of players who could really create for themselves or others just by going down there and having the oversight and the overview and everything of just knowing what to do. It's all about execution and understanding what to do. Last season for the Bulls, with Robin Lopez getting post touches and basically being asked to take, 10 shots a game from the post, that's not how it's done. And I think that's where fans might be upset and going, hey, you know what, that's not efficient basketball. And that's right. I totally agree with you, by the way, in terms of, like, we shouldn't demonize post play. I just think for Bulls fans, it's a reaction, from the days of force feeding Robin Lopez in the post.
Yeah, I think you're 100% right. And here's the thing. If the Bulls do plan on running Lowry at center, Lowry's often going to be the guy that's screening at the top for someone like Zach LaVine. And in those situations, that's going to be a tough call for the defense to make, whether they switch or whether they try to get over that screen and retain their direct matchup. But in the event that they do switch, you're going to have a guy who's maybe an undersized shooting guard that was guarding Zach LaVine, all of a sudden now guarding Lauri Markkanen. And if the ball goes back to Lauri and he has that switch on him, you don't necessarily want Lauri being on the perimeter trying to shoot over that player or trying to dribble past that player, because right, that won't always work. So Lauri having that post ability to take someone down on the block and draw a foul and get to the line and put that team in foul pressure by playing the post, I think makes more sense against mismatches than it does necessarily against direct matchups in the post. You know, if it's Joel Embiid guarding Lowry on the block, then maybe you don't necessarily go into that post option. But if you do get that mismatch and Lowry has that mismatch, then post play for Lowry does make sense, either for his own score or for, you know, the distribution aspect of his game, which needs to lift in this upcoming season. So to answer your question, Jermaine, the post option should be something for Lowry to incorporate more in his game. We don't necessarily want to see him being used as Robin Lopez, but to diversify his offense, then it should be something that's part of his game. But more, we do have one more here that I want to loop in, and I think I want to loop it in because I haven't necessarily got your opinion on it. It's been a while since we've done one of these, but this one comes in from the Breaking Ankles podcast, and he asks, will a healthy team put us in the 8th seed? So taking that question on board, and more generally, I'm interested to hear your thoughts about where you see the Bulls sort of heading, because they've had a productive offseason. We've talked about Satoransky and maybe his perceptions being lifted amongst us Bulls fans and maybe getting a little bit more excited about things. But do you think a healthy Bulls team can sneak into the 8th seed? I haven't asked you that question, so let's get it on record now.
Yeah, I think they can. I think a lot of things has to go right. And I really like the roster. What it comes down to for me is when I look at the roster, I do see an opening in the East for these guys, pending, of course, that they develop correctly. And that's really the trick of it. Because if Wendell Carter Jr. is forced to play basically like Robin Lopez was played because of Jim Boylan, that's not going to help the team. If Lauri Markkanen is forced to play a lot of center and play traditional center basketball, that's not going to help the team. So it comes down to the coaching, I feel like. If Jim Boylan is not up to the task of playing basketball that resembles 2019 era style, then it becomes a problem. And then it becomes something where I definitely see the cap of this team decrease a fair bit. The roster has a lot of potential, both, you know, from a lot of individual talents in terms of especially Carter and Markkanen and LaVine, but just in terms of how it fits together. I actually like the puzzle that's been built here. Now it's a matter of the guy who's trotting them out there, Jim Boylan, if he has no clue what to do with these guys and he consistently puts them in the incorrect places and incorrect situations, then this team could go south real quick. But yes, I do think there is a scenario wherein the Bulls make the playoffs. They do have to have a very, very strong start to the season because their schedule at the end of the year is brutal. I wrote about this on Forbes a couple months back, I feel like. And they really have to get it going early in the season to get a strong foothold on the Eastern Conference. And you have to wonder if Jim Boylan is up to that task.
100% agree. I mean, we can talk all we want about this upcoming season, but it all is dependent on Jim Boylan, unfortunately. But I mean, that's the reality of the situation. But we're not far away from learning about that and how that all plays out, because we're only 2 weeks away from media day, from training camp, and preseason is pretty much 2.5 weeks away, which is just crazy to think about. Now that the World Cup is done, NBA basketball is just around the corner, and obviously the Bulls will be back very soon, Bulls fans. So Mort, I appreciate you coming on and taking these listeners' questions, talking to SI Top 100, all of that. I was happy to gloat about Satoransky as well, because that has left me feeling pretty positive, particularly after the World Cup. So thanks for coming on, man, and tell the people where they can follow you online. You've mentioned it a little bit. Obviously, they can catch you on Forbes. But where can they? Is there one central place where they can keep a hold of all the things you're doing?
Well, I'm on Twitter, and thank you for having me, first and foremost. I'm on Twitter at MSJNBA, and I run a podcast with Brian Toporek called The NBA Podcast. Very original, I know. But it's getting a good traction and love doing it. We record somewhere around 2 times a week. And it's a lot of fun to just talk about the NBA wide and broad and come here and talk about one team for 40 minutes. It's something that I don't really get a whole lot of chances to do. And I think that's very interesting as well, because then you can go a little bit deeper. So thank you for having me. And Mark, honestly, I mean, I'm going to Chicago to watch the Bulls play Giannis and, coincidentally, Robin Lopez here in November. It's about time you join me in Chicago, isn't it?
One day, mate. One day. The old bank balance is a bit low at the moment, but one day I plan on getting over there. I have no idea when that'll be. It'll probably be in like 30 years' time or something, but one day.
Well, let me know. Then we'll coordinate.
All right. I'll let you know in 30 years' time, and then we'll work it out.
All right. I'll definitely get up from my grave by that point. Of course.
Well, I mean, hopefully that's not the case, but I'll hit you up in 30 years and we can organize that, mate. But yeah, thanks again for coming on.
And thank you for having me. Take care, man.
All right, Bulls fans, so that just about does it for this episode of Bulls HQ. Thank you for tuning in. As always, follow me on Twitter at NK Hoops. Follow the show at Bulls HQ Pod. Send me an email if you want. If you've got any ideas for the show, any questions, if you just want to have a long form chat about the Bulls, send them to BullsHQPod@gmail.com. I'm happy to answer any and all questions that you may have. But that just about does it for this episode of the show. We'll be back next week when we're ever so close to the NBA season. So be on the lookout for that. But until then, this has been Bulls HQ. Speak then, Bulls fans.